Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 120, where we discuss an important work from institution theory, Paul DiMaggio and Walter Powell's The Iron Cage Revisited, Institutional Isomorphism and Collective Rationality in Organizations, published in the American Sociological Review in 1983. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Rohan from London.
Hi, this is Sarah from London.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. And following what was an episode on the longest book we had read to this point, we decided to go ahead and give ourselves a nice short article. But boy, is this a powerful article. This is The Iron Cage Revisited, Institutional Isomorphism and Collective Rationality in Organizational Fields by Paul DiMaggio and Walter Powell from 1983. We sort of are coming back into what has been a recent series, you might say, that we've covered several episodes on institutionalization in the last couple of years. And this is another one of the classics, which takes more of a, I would call it a more strategic view. Where were you looking at the impact of institutionalization on organizations and society, et cetera? And it begins with a reach back to Weber, who we covered all the way back in episode 6, and the imagery that he used of the iron cage. And I'll just read a passage from him real briefly. The imagery of the iron cage has haunted students of society as the tempo of bureaucratization has quickened. While bureaucracy has spread continuously in the 80 years since Weber wrote, we suggest that the engine of organizational rationalization has shifted. So originally, what he is referring to as the iron cage is how the rationalist order has become an entrapment for people of society, which was driven mostly in Weber's time as kind of like capitalism and bureaucratization. And what this article is suggesting is that there's a bit of a difference that has happened as we've been, you know, in 1983, this was the movement toward an information-driven society in which the engines, institutionalization, entraps members of society or organizations into norms that they are forced to adapt to and can't break from. We're finding people in a different cage. So they're revisiting the Iron Cage in 1983. We'll discuss the article and then perhaps revisit the revisitation of the Iron Cage circa 2024.
And this is also joining two other strands in our episodes. One, as you already said, on institutions and institutionalization, and another on professions and expertise. So there's quite a discussion about the two different levels of analysis. So what's happening to organizations, but also what's happening to individuals and how to differentiate among them at each level. And so that connects to work that we've had before. So we've had episodes on the Pfeffer and Salinchik 116 that they cite in here, on Abbott on professions, which is episode 67, and on Guldner on bureaucracy, which is episode 78, going through about how all of these forces are affecting at two different levels of analysis. So macro people, we're talking to you here. Micro people, we're talking to you today. It's a rather short but punchy article that probably addresses our original birth of the podcast on essentially giving yourself a doctoral education one episode at a time. So this is definitely, I would say, on most doctoral syllabi these days, although hands up, it was not on mine. So if you're learning alongside us today, welcome. And we are, you know, filling the gaps in our org theory education one episode at a time.
just one more way to kind of situate this. So one is what, Tom, you were mentioning about Max Weber and his concept of the Iron Cage, and that was kind of commentary on modernity, and the authors here, DiMaggio and Paul, start off with that and definitely situate the paper there. But the other thing that's going on in OT at this time, which we've also discussed in the past, is, for example, population ecology. It was popular in the kind of late 70s onwards, and they cite them a lot as well and situate themselves there, where a lot of the kind of evolutionary theories or population ecology type scholars were interested in variation and kind of what firms die out versus survive based on differences between organizations. They situate this paper saying we're more curious why organizations are actually so similar rather than so different.
I'll also add that this paper precedes Abbott. So some of the works that Abbott had cited would fall largely within this view of professionalization. But Abbott's work came later. So one of the things we'll probably address in later on in this episode is sort of like introducing Abbott's view of professionalization and how it actually enhances and strengthens some of the arguments here.
I was going to add that as well as population ecology being born, we also are talking about networks. So this is following a strand we've done with a few episodes on networks and networking and the difference between networks and communities, networks and hierarchies. So there are the beginnings of using status as a heuristic and uncertainty, how the pathways that are set down to get to university and in early jobs, do they give us path dependence or do they give us any source of variety at all? And the authors are very clear on their position for it. So I think that even though this is obviously written for and used to understand the survival and thriving or the demise of organizations, you can see how the small world of academia back then was always looking at people in their relation to their organization of all types, not just for-profit entities, but of all different types and structures. So there's that in here too.
Yeah, and I mean, it's already coming out through us trying to kind of introduce this paper, how good a job they did of talking to so many groups, kind of with my PhD student hat on. And fortunately, this was part of my syllabus. And I remember noticing how well situated it was in the conversations of the time. And I'm sure we can come back to this later in the episode, but that must have played a big role in its impact as well. The fact that it's not just interesting ideas, but they're doing such a kind of masterful craftsmanship of positioning it in all these strands of thought, of social thought, at least in kind of the US in the mid to late 20th century.
Which it has to do because it's a theory only paper. Even though it makes propositions called hypotheses, which is just a massive future research section before you get to implications for social theory, it very explicitly says, it follows from our discussion of the mechanisms by which isomorphic change occurs, that we should be able to predict empirically which fields will be most homogeneous in structure and process, while an empirical test of such predictions is beyond the scope of this paper, right? We are writing a theory paper. The rest of you may continue the investigations from here forward. So it's quite, as you say, it's economical in words because it's a theory paper, it's quite punchy, and it is quite important in the field for both of those things.
Yeah, and I think we can kind of get into what they're doing with this, because there's several terms which really are important and central to their point, because they're trying to wrap their arms around a rather diverse set of literature streams. And so one of the first terms that they define is that of an organizational field. And this is where we get into the macro sense. What is the macro level that we're talking about? So page 148, at the bottom of the first column, they define it, what they call. And it's, by organizational field, we mean those organizations that, in the aggregate, constitute a recognized area of institutional life. Key suppliers, resource and product consumers, regulatory agencies, and other organizations that produce similar products or services. You know, they sort of open the aperture beyond, say, the conception of an industry. Like, you know, an industry would be just one type of an organizational field. There's all sorts of other types of, you know, organizations that collectively might behave in a similar fashion, regulatory agencies would be an obvious one. You know, how do enforcement mechanisms become shared across different organizations who are doing the enforcing? That, you know, institutional norms across those would become potentially isomorphic. So the idea is to come up with this first term of a field. What are the qualities that they sort of exhibit? And they offer two, connectedness and structural equivalence, which would be two different ways in which you would see organizations within a field start to share information and adopt others' practices and thereby modify their structures to look like everybody else.
Yeah, and I think the fact that this is kind of the first thing they define in the paper, given that I'm, let's say, revisiting this many years later from my after my first reading, I had actually lost track of how critical this is to their argument, because a lot of listeners already, let's say, who might, even if you haven't read the paper, you might know it as the isomorphism paper, and we'll talk about that as we go along. But all of their arguments about how organizations are similar and how there's homogeneity in fields starts with the predicate of, as a field becomes highly structured. So there's kind of a dynamism to it where they say early on in the emergence of a field, you could see a lot of variety. You might see a bit more of the population ecology kind of view where some organizations are dying, some are surviving. But as a field becomes very structured, you start to see more of these isomorphic kind of this homogeneity pressures at play. And I think I had at some point lost track of that dynamism in their argument of how it's, or at least that the fact that it's contingent on the field being highly structured. And then kind of picking up from where you left off, Tom, they talk about how kind of the structure of a field cannot be determined a priori, and it's something you figure out from certain factors, and they list kind of four factors of a structured field. One is an increase in the extent of interaction among organizations in the field. Second is the emergence of sharply defined inter-organizational structures of domination and patterns of coalition. Third is an increase in the information load with which organizations must contend. And fourth is the development of a mutual awareness among participants that they are involved in a common enterprise. And so kind of the structuration is, let's say, evident when you see these four factors or these four quality in an organization field, and then the rest of the argument kind of follows from there.
And for our micro listeners, that knowing that you are and believing that you are in a team or a group, that's the same definition that we need to establish an identity there and to start building cohesion, is the recognition that you are in a group. So there is some cross-level agreement with that. And what I think is really interesting, and I will defer to you about this, but in any time you set up a new definition, if it's a construct, if it's an aggregate like this, there has to be a need that the existing definitions did not meet. And there have to be sharp boundaries of what you include and what you don't. So I think what's really interesting for me in the definition of a field is trying to keep very clear all these words like sector, industry, competition space, like you were talking about, Rohan, the ecology. So who else is in your pool or your pond, depending on the size of your pond? Sometimes now you'll hear the phrase basket of peers, right? Or your comparison set. So all these different ways of grouping relativity. So you have to then say, well, why do we need another one? So there's something inadequate about existing what we have. Well, let's take industry, right? If you say what's inadequate about industry, well, there are cross-industry relationships that can be involved here. There's interoperability, there's supplier and buyer relationships, there's different information sharing. So, okay, I buy that one. So every time you have to unpick the relationship of this definition to the others is what's the same and what's different. And I think then when you sit back, obviously with the benefit of hindsight, but when you look and you think there was no definition of this before, and this is the gold standard definition now, you really understand the step change, I think, in the field of org theory or in management research from here. It's one of those career defining movements, right? So what we all are told that we're looking for with our own independent research, with our dissertations, with our tenure making papers, whatever the next great piece will be. This is the thing that's going to be taught on doctoral syllabi for 20, 30, 40 years. And it was just as, I won't call it simple because of course it's a complex contribution, but it's as clear as doing something like this. Finding a problem, finding the existing opportunities inadequate, solving the problem, and claiming the space.
Yeah, and I wonder if, and I don't really know this, but is it a part of this just that when we've been traditionally up to this point thinking about organizations, we've tended to think about goods more than services? Because when we start talking about professionalization, we definitely move into services. And I'm not talking just about services provided to a consumer, but when you start talking about regulatory agencies, these are services, although the recipient of the service may not see it as a service, but it is a different beast from producing goods and trying to come up with an umbrella that describes a phenomenon across that type of diversity or of organizations would seem like that would be.
Well, I think your highlighting of services would fit with their discussion of these para organizations. So standard setting and enforcement bodies, but also there's a large section in the middle on consultancies, which are the archetypical, you know, professional services firm, and how the pool of consultancies and the models that they sell and push shape forces as well, government agencies. So what the widget you make is grew at this point, of course, how legitimate and formal the person making the widget was, i.e. professionalization, grew as well. But it was these different organizations for different purposes rather than these monolithic institutions that do everything. So whether they're services or not, as you've said, I don't feel 100% the expert to comment on that, but certainly whether they are the institutions of yore or modern, I think is something we can agree on. That's clear in the paper.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing about this concept of fields is, and I don't, of course, know the historiography of the paper or what their thought process was, but if one were to start with the point, with that insight of, oh, these organizations are so similar, how are they becoming so similar, given that, let's say, rational theories might suggest more adaptation. At some point, as you're chasing down this logic of what's driving the similarity, you're quite likely to think about, okay, there's regulatory agencies at play, there's consulting firms at play, there's all these other actors that are kind of spreading this homogenization, or at least, if not enforcing it, at least kind of serving as a glue for it. And so then you end up with this kind of emergent concept as well of a field structure beyond just, let's say, an industry or just a supplier-buyer relationship when you're trying to understand homogenization.
Yes, and by the way, the source given was DiMaggio's own paper from the year prior, which was a symposium paper. That's basically where this field or this concept of organizational field is, you know, being introduced as like a, you know, as the outcome of his prior work. But he does go through and provide the basis for all four of those elements. And it's a who's who of other papers that we've covered in the podcast. We covered Selznick 1957, basically describing the powerful forces at work, which we showed in the or was shown in the Tennessee Valley Authority example he gave. And he also cited Meyer and Rowan, which was just a few episodes back. They eventually come to the conclusion that the concept that best captures the process of homogenization is isomorphism. And now we're on page 149. And they define it as a constraining process that forces one unit in a population to resemble other units that face the same set of environmental conditions. And the environmental conditions are kind of important because it also gets into the two types of isomorphism that they explain, one being competitive and the other being institutional. They draw from another paper to describe the competitive isomorphism, which is essentially the strongest survive or the best practices survive. Whatever it is that is a winning formula becomes adopted by everybody else. The institutional formula or the institutional form is a little bit different in that it is a comparison of social along with economic fitness. So not necessarily that the best idea wins, but perhaps the best idea that society tolerates or society is willing to go along with is the one that wins. And these isomorphic processes manifest differently, but they still have the same homogenizing effect on organizations within a field.
So if we just take one moment to look at competitive processes, because that's all the paper really uses, everything else is about institutional. So in addition to the stronger survive, or the, if you use the evolutionary language with population ecology, right, that you, the best adapted to the environment will survive. I did think I could have used a couple more examples. So it cites Aldrich that major factors that organizations must take into account are other organizations, and that competition is for resources and customers, but also power and legitimacy, and also social and economic fitness. And essentially, if you understand that, you understand competition completely. I would have liked to see some canonical examples we could rely on for what has done this well or what led us to agree with this. I just thought, given that it's one of the two branches of logic, I understand the reason for developing the new one, right? Institutional isomorphism. But I just would have liked, since perhaps now it's become such a standard setting paper, at least, you know, the rest of the column inches on some canonical examples. So I don't know if either of you have something that you would like to mention, or maybe we can bring this up again in part two, because part two is usually where we ping pong back to the authors rather than just progressing through the paper one at a time. But I would like to think what would have been a contemporary example of what suffered or felt competitive pressure and therefore became so similar.
Yeah, I also think, because at that time you have, you know, Pfeffer and Szalancsik, external control of organizations. I think you had James Thompson and Organizations in Action. All of these books had kind of a propositional view of in environment X, you'll see Y kind of structure or kind of organizational behavior. You're right that it's kind of, it's underexplored in this paper, what that first type of isomorphism is. When I read it, at least I saw it as that more deterministic style of, if you have technology X, you should set up as Y, or if you have, if you're playing in market X, this is the correct, most efficient, rationally optimal way to do it. So all players in market X will start adopting that kind of form or behavior.
Well, let me offer one example that's coming to mind that maybe explains the challenge of separating the two. Because I could come up with one example of force of isomorphism that has either a competitive or an institutional bent, depending on how you look at it. And this is the adoption of learning management and homework assignment type systems used in primary education, something I happen to have some recent familiarity with. What he had during the pandemic, for example, was the sudden adoption of using online mechanisms for doing all sorts of things in primary education. Now, there were competitive isomorphism, I think, in the fact of there was a lot of competition over what constitutes a valid and usable type of a material to pass over this remote medium. And it wasn't necessarily about what was the most effective, but what could be generated quickly and that would be engaging in such a fashion that students would actually suffer through going through these remote learning modules. And I use this term suffer. It's not necessarily the kids that suffered. It was the parents sometimes. Never mind. But the key was that there were competitive norms, I would say, that were at play because different organizations were trying to push, you know, make their content available really, really quickly. And they all did kind of adopt some norms that involve some degree of interactivity. And the ones that were the most interactive or the ones that could hold the students' attention tended to win out. Institutionally, I think if we take an institutional isomorphism lens, we can look at it sort of from the teacher's perspective, because there were norms and expectations rooted in the original classroom environment by which the teachers still had to figure out how to grade, assess, you know, be involved with and try to figure out how, like there were pressures placed upon the teachers to try to replicate the classroom as much as possible because that's what was known. And I think that kind of falls into the institutional isomorphism, whereas in reality, in retrospect, there probably would have been better off blowing the whole thing up and starting over if we knew, which we did may not have known at the time, the extent to which the pandemic would last and would be so disruptive to how we did things. Maybe that describes what happened when we got past 2020 and into the next year when we suddenly realized, oh dear, we're going to have to stay with our pandemic approach through the entire school year of 2020-2021. And now we've got to come up with some standards of expectations or something. And isomorphism came, you know, was manifested what this new normal was, which thankfully is no longer the new normal. Is that helpful?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And kind of while you were laying that out, I recalled a quote from earlier in the paper, which also helps us parse out maybe this competitive isomorphism versus institutional isomorphism. On page 148, they say, as an innovation spreads, a threshold is reached beyond which adoption provides legitimacy rather than improves performance. And so if you're in that early stage of performance improvement, it's probably competitive isomorphism. When it's moved beyond that threshold, it's probably institutional. So if you think of the example of AI, you could be, let's say, a company that needs a chatbot on your website for some reason, to the extent that now you're getting onto the AI bandwagon because everyone is using it, but it actually makes a chatbot way better, customers are happier, etc. That's competitive isomorphism because you're increasing your performance or lowering your costs either ways. Versus, let's say, you actually had your kind of chat functionality down to an art and it was already doing its job, but you're bringing in AI functionality just because it would look bad if you didn't, because you would send the message that you're not on top of new technologies or whatever, then it's more institutional isomorphism, even though in both cases the act is the same. You're just bringing AI into your chatbot.
At the same time, I think there's also the institutional in terms of how society responds to it and the rejection of AI or the rebellion of AI intruding into areas that people feel less comfortable about, and it becomes a balancing out. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think in terms of the theoretical framework, it fits under. So there's an audience element or a societal element to what constitutes the correct move, let's say, from an isomorphic perspective. So correct, if the audience is rejecting it or if people are finding it overdone, then you move away, or the field moves away from that behavior.
So shall we then move to the mechanisms of institutional isomorphic change? So the three proposed mechanisms, which themselves are swiftly followed by a caveat that the typology is an analytic one, these types are not always empirically distinct. So if that was going to be your reaction, gold star to you, now you have to do the hard work and lift under the hood. So the three mechanisms that they identify are coercive from political influence and, quote, the problem of legitimacy. We are halfway through page 150 where this is. Mimetic, resulting from standard responses to uncertainty, and normative, associated with professionalization. So you will hear that we have largely identified these three ourselves at this point in our review. So then they go on to define them and actually link to some of the core sources we already mentioned, because I think, just as a small aside, this paper is a really interesting example of they say, I say is what we're taught in doctoral courses or in writing courses even, but for a theory paper, a very low reliance on citations because of the time period, right? That was normative at the time period. Now you need to signpost, as well as finding a way to put your own voice in the middle. So this is definitely a do as I say, not as I do, but only because of the time period. So looking through, taking them in turn, so let's look at coercive isomorphism. So they say that coercive isomorphism results from both formal and informal pressures exerted on organizations by other organizations upon which they are dependent, and also by cultural expectations. So societal placement, societal context, historical context, as well as direct expectations from interaction partners. So immediately my first reaction to this section is that their expression explicitly that coercive and normative are different. Whereas, again, coming up from a micro background, what they describe is exactly normative pressure, right? It's about impression management. It's about fitting in. It's about generally responding to the need to demonstrate that you belong, that legitimacy, that in-group, out-group belongingness. So for me, that was directly fitting to social norms. So I thought that just the choice of label, which of course becomes an enduring part of the paper, right? It sets the new language, new construct, new language, an enduring part of the paper. So I thought that was really interesting that they really wanted to distinguish between coercive and normative. But maybe that's just my personal background, personal penchant. I don't know if that triggered either the two of you.
Well, it did with me as well. But where I come from, I do tend to separate external stimuli from internal stimuli, or like homegrown stimuli. Both can have a coercive impact. And I think that that was, you know, it was really just sort of like the locus of the change. You know, how does the external control, which could be customers, could be regulatory agencies, et cetera, impose themselves on the organizational field versus what emerges from within the boundary. And I wouldn't have restricted it to professionalization, but then again, this is pre-Abbott. So I can understand why they used that term. But in the normative sense, this is about the collective struggle of members of an occupation to define the condition of methods of their work, which is largely like, for example, what we do within academia. We create, we come up with ways of doing research, of publishing results or whatever that come, and we adopt what makes sense among other professionals. So within the boundary of the organizational form, there are pressures that exert themselves differently than what comes from outside the form. And I think that's really the essence of the distinction. They both have a normative impact. You got to come up with a different term.
Yeah. In my reading, though, it was less, I would say, of the external, internal, and more of they did mean it in terms of coercion versus, let's say, emergent from the bottom up. Because when they talk about the normative isomorphism, they do talk about professions, but they're clear that that goes across the boundaries of an organization. So they talk a lot about if you hire personnel from the same universities, you're getting the same kind of way of viewing problems and solving problems in your organization. And so that normative isomorphism is starting at the training level of the profession. So it's starting outside the organization, essentially, but you're hiring from the same places. But coercive isomorphism is more when there's, for example, a legal or regulatory requirement where you must. So there's not really as much of a voluntary element. Of course, keeping in mind what Sarah highlighted, which is that these aren't always empirically distinct. But an example that they use for coercive isomorphism, which I think can help us, let me see if I can use that example to then parse between the three kinds, the same example in different ways. But they talk about a nonprofit organization kind of hiring accountants and developing sophisticated accounting systems for the sake of tax requirements, not because it's necessarily needed for their work or their customers or what they're trying to do. They use that as an example of coercive isomorphism, where you have these requirements, so now everyone has to adopt that practice. A mimetic version of that same thing would be if people are adopting it not because of a legal requirement, but because it looks sophisticated and they want to signal to the market that, look, we do the same thing that DuPont does or AT&T does with our kind of accounting and cost management. And then a normative isomorphism would be if they're hiring the same accountants from Harvard Business School or whatever, who are bringing in their values, regardless of whether it's good or whether it has a competitive fit for the particular nonprofit.
I think that's super helpful. And I think my initial hesitancy was just their expansion of the definition, not from the political or regulatory influence that you were talking about, from what they say is the problem of legitimacy. So just to take the not-for-profit example a bit further, In order for that to be the case, you would have to say that any nonprofit that therefore did not engage in formal accounting to this standard open and transparent reporting would therefore no longer be a legitimate not-for-profit, and the consequence of that would be, and therefore should not receive your donations, right? Or should not be allowed to receive donations, or should not enjoy favorable tax status, whatever your desired dependent variable, you know, would be in that situation. So I think that's the part that obviously, because of my own work in expertise and legitimacy, was most interesting to me, and therefore I found was not as clear as the way that Rowan had just explained it to us. So I would say, if you are also reading and struggling as I was, go with Rowan's example, because trying to follow their examples specifically and fit it in these boxes, and then, as we will discuss, you know, as later in the episode, trying to bring them up to date into 2024, you might not find as clear boundaries or as clear examples, because you're absolutely right that most of the coercive ones would start from structures, what we used to say, I guess, were institutions. So the law, the professional societies, the IRS, religious institutions, and then religious versions of all of these other institutions as well. So I therefore am now prepared to accept these three different ones. And actually, I think I'm glad we've gone through them one at a time, or we will be going through them one at a time, because until then, I think I was really considering isomorphism only as the mimetic force. Perhaps, again, that's my own background steering my interests. But the idea that we would all end up looking like each other, or what they say on 151 to 152, is that despite considerable search for diversity, there was relatively little variation to be selected from. For me, that was the mimetic force before that. So I actually think it's quite interesting to try and figure out the same outcome, but from those other two forces.
Yeah, and I think what's implicit in this paper that perhaps could have been a more explicit dimension is what forms of authority are you bowing to or are driving these processes? For example, like we said, when it comes to the coercive isomorphism, they use those examples of legal structures, tax, regulatory, etc. Now on our mimetic isomorphism, they talk about consulting firms, where it is less, let's say, formal authority and a bit more chosen authority, where you've chosen to consult with this firm and it lends legitimacy. I do like the example they use there for a mimetic isomorphism in page 152, where they talk about a public television station where a consulting firm told them to switch from a functional design of their organization to what was called an M-form structure, so the multi-divisional structure. And I quote, "The station's executives were skeptical that the new structure was more efficient. In fact, some services were now duplicated across divisions. But they were convinced that the new design would carry a powerful message to the for-profit firms with whom the station regularly dealt. These firms, whether in the role of corporate underwriters or as potential partners in joint ventures, would view the reorganization as a sign that the sleepy nonprofit station was becoming more business-minded." And that's an example where the symbolic has, of course, real consequences. You want these people who are your future underwriters or helping you conduct M&A or whatever it is to think of you as a legitimate business-minded organization, even if you know your business better and you know that actually the M-form structure might not make sense. There could be benefits to the isomorphism.
So I think we can move on to the predictors of isomorphic change. And this is where they conclude the article basically with a bunch of these hypotheses in which they went by level or by locus. The first set being organizational level predictors, the second being field level predictors. So it's a set of hypotheses of which you look at what would produce isomorphic change within an individual organization, and then a set of hypotheses that are oriented across an organizational field, what would happen within an organizational field. And just to read them off real quick, set A under organizational level was number one, the greater the dependence of an organization on another organization, the more similar it will become to that organization in structure, climate, and behavioral focus. Number two, the greater the centralization of organization A's resource supply, the greater the extent to which Organization A will change isomorphically to resemble the organizations on which it depends for resources. And the third one is, the more uncertain the relationship between means and ends, the greater the extent to which an organization will model itself after other organizations it perceives to be successful. So, you know, successful begets success. There are three others. I won't read them all because you can read them all in pages 154 and 155, but you can see that each of these give examples of potential research areas to show whether or not isomorphism can be predicted at the organizational level there. They do the same thing, and it's essentially the same six hypotheses at the field level, just simply saying across organizations as opposed to within an organization.
And then kind of just the added structure layer to that is they seem to partition each of those six into those three isomorphic types. So they say the first two hypotheses follow from a discussion of coercive isomorphism. Then they talk about, they say, you know, the three and four follow from a discussion of normative, and then five and six follow from our discussion of, normative was the five and six, and three and four was mimetic isomorphism. And so you see some of the threads continue, where now when they get to hypotheses five and six, let's say in the case of org level predictors, they talk about reliance on academic credentials. They talk about participating in trade and professional associations, because they're drawing on the arguments they made about how a lot of normative isomorphism happens through the functioning of professions and socialization. Just to pick up on Sarah's point, I mean, that's the other thing with, I guess, the way theory was done back then, where you're not entirely sure what the driving engine is for why these hypotheses versus not. Similar to how when they start off the whole section on isomorphism, they just say we identified three kinds of isomorphism, and then you're wondering, you know, is that an exhaustive list? How did you partition that? Which is why we were struggling. What's the engine? Is the engine about formal versus informal authority? How is that typology being generated, essentially? So that kind of follows through a little bit here as well, but it is internally coherent, certainly, with the arguments that they're making.
And also the same question to level of analysis, right? So in the definition of fields being organizations that are interdependent, you would expect that org would be nested under field. And yet by spreading them out into six hypotheses this way, or six by two, so 12 hypotheses in this way, it destabilizes your understanding in a way of whether you have to have evidence of 1 through 6A for then 1 through 6B to apply, which is what you would do in a nested analysis. Or if the field is the stronger dependence, this new construct defined and of a force of its own, then is it that if you have evidence for B 1 through 6, then even it, without the conditions of A 1 through 6, B conditions would still apply and these results or these consequences would still occur, right? I'm not sure, but in terms of mathematically which way I would go, I agree with Rowan that none of them is particularly controversial, and so therefore they would not be sufficient conditions of their own, and potentially a certain number of them would be necessary conditions, or you might say one at each level would be necessary. But I think the whole gist of the article, as in the bits that we've quoted before, is that we're tending towards a stability system, right? We're tending away from entropy. Perhaps it doesn't even really matter how many of the 12 your context of interest can demonstrate. It maybe that only affects the length of time it takes to get to stability, aka isomorphism. I don't know. What do you think?
I was just going to say that, I too found it curious that they went with organizations before fields, because I would have done the other way around. But I think they sort of left it open, which maybe it was at the time rather uncertain, which really was the stronger predictor, organizational context or the field context. Don't know.
But I think you have a point there, Sarah, where kind of the gist of this empirical investigation wouldn't anyways be to explain too much variance per se. So we start thinking in terms of, okay, then which one is more homogeneous than the other, and you know, which one is how much, and so on and so forth. And early in this paper, in fact, on page 148, when they're setting up the fact that our question is why organizations are similar, they say that, and I quote, Even our investigatory technologies, for example, those based on least squares techniques, are geared towards explaining variation rather than its absence. So while they're setting forth these propositions, they perhaps don't necessarily see them being tested using regression analyses and things like that. Because otherwise those questions all come into play. Which effect is bigger? Which effects are nested? What are the interaction effects between the different hypotheses and so on and so forth? But also zooming out just to the kind of intuitive level, that's also why the real world is messy, because you could imagine that hypothesis one holds and that there is greater organizational interdependence, but hypothesis two doesn't hold, and so there isn't much centralization of resources in any given setting that you're studying. And so it's not about, let's say, a differential effect. It's just about any of these processes would probably be driving homogenization.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.